I know you don't like parties, neither do I. But sometimes I wonder. Perhaps we're the only ones who are meant to be able to enjoy them. I am afraid I have no talent for it. Not for this. But do you think any of these people are enjoying it? They're just straining to be more senseless and aimless than usual, to be light and unimportant. You know, I think that only if one feels immensely important can one feel truly light. I wouldn't know. It's just a thought that disturbs me once in a while. I thought it about my first ball. I kept thinking that parties are intended to be celebrations, and celebrations should be only for those who have something to celebrate. I have never thought of it. She could not adapt her words to the rigid formality of his manner. She could not quite believe it. They had always been at ease together in his office. Now he was like a man in a straitjacket. Hank, look at it. If you didn't know any of these people, wouldn't it seem beautiful? The lights and the clothes and all the imagination that went to make it possible? She was looking at the room. She did not notice that he had not followed her glance. He was looking down at the shadows on her naked shoulder, the soft blue shadows made by the light that fell through the strands of her hair. Why have we left it all to fools? It should have been ours. In what manner? I don't know. I've always expected parties to be exciting and brilliant, like some rare drink. She laughed. There was a note of sadness in it. But I don't drink either. That's just another symbol that doesn't mean what it was intended to mean. He was silent. She added, "Perhaps there's something that we have missed." "I am not aware of it." In a flash of sudden, desolate emptiness, she was glad that he had not understood or responded, feeling dimly that she had revealed too much, yet not knowing what she had revealed. She shrugged, the movement running through the curve of her shoulder like a faint convulsion. "It's just an old illusion of mine," she said indifferently. "Just a mood that comes once every year or two. Let me see the latest steel price index, and I'll forget all about it." She did not know that his eyes were following her as she walked away from him. She moved slowly through the room, looking at no one. She noticed a small group huddled by the unlighted fireplace. The room was not cold, but they sat as if they drew comfort from the thought of a non-existent fire. "I don't know why, but I am growing to be afraid of the dark. No, not now. Only when I am alone. What frightens me is night. Night as such." The speaker was an elderly spinster with an air of breeding and hopelessness. The three women and two men of the group were well-dressed. The skin of their faces was smoothly well-tended. But they had a manner of anxious caution that kept their voices one tone lower than normal and blurred the differences of their ages, giving them all the same gray look of being spent. It was the look one saw in groups of respectable people everywhere. Dagny stopped and listened. "But, my dear," one of them asked, "why should it frighten you?" "I don't know," said the spinster. "I am not afraid of prowlers or robberies or anything of the sort, but I stay awake all night. I fall asleep only when I see the sky turning pale. It is very odd. Every evening when it grows dark, I get the feeling that this time it is final, that daylight will not return." "My cousin who lives on the coast of Maine wrote me the same thing," said one of the women. "Last night," said the spinster, "I stayed awake because of the shooting. There were guns going off all night way out at sea. There were no flashes, there was nothing. Just those detonations at long intervals, somewhere in the fog over the Atlantic. I read something about it in the paper this morning. Coast Guard target practice." "Why, no," the spinster said indifferently. "Everybody down on the shore knows what it was. It was Ragnar Danishold. It was the Coast Guard trying to catch him."
"Ragnar Danishold in Delaware Bay?" a woman gasped.
"Oh, yes. They say it is not the first time."
"Did they catch him?"
"No. Nobody can catch him," said one of the men. "The People's State of Norway has offered $1 million reward for his head. That's an awful lot of money to pay for a pirate's head. But how are we going to have any order or security or planning in the world with a pirate running loose all over the seven seas?" "Do you know what it was that he seized last night?" said the spinster.
the big ship with the relief supplies we were sending to the People's State of France.
How does he dispose of the goods he seizes?
Ah, that. Nobody knows.
I met a sailor once from a ship he'd attacked who'd seen him in person. He said that Ragnar Danishold has the purest gold hair and the most frightening face on earth, a face with no sign of any feeling. If there ever was a man born without a heart, he's it, the sailor said.
A nephew of mine saw Ragnar Danishold's ship one night off the coast of Scotland. He wrote me that he couldn't believe his eyes. It was a better ship than any in the navy of the People's State of England.
They say he hides in one of those Norwegian fjords, where neither God nor man will ever find him. That's where the Vikings used to hide in the Middle Ages. There's a reward on his head offered by the People's State of Portugal, too, and the People's State of Turkey. They say it's a national scandal in Norway. He comes from one of their best families. The family lost its money generations ago, but the name is of the noblest. The ruins of their castle are still in existence. His father is a bishop. His father has disowned him and excommunicated him, but it had no effect.
Did you know that Ragnar Danishold went to school in this country?
Sure. The Patrick Henry University.
Not really.
Oh, yes, you can look it up.
What bothers me is, you know, I don't like it. I don't like it that he's now appearing right here in our own waters. I thought things like that could happen only in the wastelands, only in Europe. But a big-scale outlaw of that kind, operating in Delaware, in our day and age?
He's been seen off Nantucket, too, and at Bar Harbor. The newspapers have been asked not to write about it.
Why?
They don't want people to know that the Navy can't cope with him.
I don't like it. It feels funny. It's like something out of the Dark Ages.
Dagny glanced up. She saw Francisco D'Anconia standing a few steps away. He was looking at her with a kind of stressed curiosity. His eyes were mocking.
"It's a strange world we're living in," said the spinster, her voice low.
"I read an article," said one of the women tonelessly. "It said that times of trouble are good for us. It is good that people are growing poorer. To accept privations is a moral virtue."
"I suppose so," said another without conviction.
"We must not worry. I heard a speech that said it is useless to worry or to blame anyone. Nobody can help what he does. That is the way things made him. There is nothing we can do about anything. We must learn to bear it."
"What's the use anyway? What is man's fate? Hasn't it always been to hope, but never to achieve? The wise man is the one who does not attempt to hope."
"That is the best attitude to take."
"I don't know. I don't know what is right anymore. How can we ever know?"
"Oh, well, who is John Galt?"
Dagny turned brusquely and started away from them. One of the women followed her.
"But I do know it," said the woman, in the soft, mysterious tone of sharing a secret.
"You know what?"
"I know who is John Galt."
"Who?" Dagny asked tensely, stopping.
"I know a man who knew John Galt in person. This man is an old friend of a great aunt of mine. He was there and he saw it happen.
Do you know the legend of Atlantis, Miss Taggart?"
"What?"
"Atlantis."
"Why?"
"Vaguely."
"The Isles of the Blessed.
That is what the Greeks called it thousands of years ago. They said Atlantis was a place where hero spirits lived in a happiness unknown to the rest of the earth, a place which only the spirits of heroes could enter, and they reached it without dying, because they carried the secret of life within them. Atlantis was lost to mankind even then, but the Greeks knew that it had existed. They tried to find it. Some of them said it was underground, hidden in the heart of the earth. But most of them said it was an island, a radiant island in the Western Ocean. Perhaps what they were thinking of was America. They never found it. For centuries afterward, men said it was only a legend. They did not believe it. But they never stopped looking for it, because they knew that that was what they had to find.
Well, what about John Galt?
He found it.
Dagny's interest was gone.
Who was he?
John Galt was a millionaire, a man of inestimable wealth. He was sailing his yacht one night, in mid-Atlantic, fighting the worst storm ever wreaked upon the world, when he found it. He saw it in the depth, where it had sunk to escape the reach of men.
he saw the towers of Atlantis shining on the bottom of the ocean. It was a sight of such kind that when one had seen it, one could no longer wish to look at the rest of the earth. John Galt sank his ship and went down with his entire crew. They all chose to do it. My friend was the only one who survived.
How interesting.
My friend saw it with his own eyes, said the woman, offended. It happened many years ago, but John Galt's family hushed up the story.
And what happened to his fortune?
I don't recall ever hearing of a Galt fortune.
It went down with him,
she added belligerently.
You don't have to believe it.
Miss Taggart doesn't, said Francisco d'Anconia. I do.
They turned. He had followed them, and he stood looking at them with the insolence of exaggerated earnestness. Have you ever had faith in anything, Signor d'Anconia? The woman asked angrily.
No, madam.
He chuckled at her brusque departure.
Dagny asked coldly,
What's the joke?
The joke's on that fool woman. She doesn't know that she was telling you the truth.
Do you expect me to believe that?
No.
Then what do you find so amusing?
Oh, a great many things here.
Don't you?
No. Well, that's one of the things I find amusing.
Francisco, will you leave me alone?
But I have. Didn't you notice that you were the first to speak to me tonight?
Why do you keep watching me?
Curiosity.
About what?
Your reaction to the things which you don't find amusing.
Why should you care about my reactions to anything?
This is my own way of having a good time. Which, incidentally, you are not having, are you, Dagny? Besides, you're the only woman worth watching here.
She stood defiantly still because the way he looked at her demanded an angry escape. She stood as she always did, straight and taut, her head lifted impatiently. It was the unfeminine pose of an executive. But her naked shoulder betrayed the fragility of the body under the black dress, and the pose made her most truly a woman. The proud strength became a challenge to someone's superior strength, and the fragility a reminder that the challenge could be broken. She was not conscious of it. She had met no one able to see it. He said, looking down at her body,
Dagny, what a magnificent waist.
She had to turn and escape. She felt herself blushing for the first time in years, blushing because she knew suddenly that the sentence named what she had felt all evening. She ran, trying not to think.
The music stopped her.
It was a sudden blast from the radio. She noticed Mort Liddy, who had turned it on, waving his arms to a group of friends, yelling,
That's it, that's it! I want you to hear it!
The great burst of sound was the opening chords of Halley's Fourth Concerto. It rose in tortured triumph, speaking its denial of pain, its hymn to a distant vision. Then the notes broke. It was as if a handful of mud and pebbles had been flung at the music, and what followed was the sound of the rolling and the dripping. It was Halley's concerto swung into a popular tune. It was Halley's melody torn apart, its holes stuffed with hiccups. The great statement of joy had become the giggling of a barroom. Yet it was still the remnant of Halley's melody that gave it form. It was the melody that supported it like a spinal cord.
Pretty good?
Mort Liddy was smiling at his friends, boastfully and nervously.
Pretty good, eh? Best movie score of the year got me a prize. Got me a long-term contract. Yeah, this was my score for Heaven's in Your Backyard.
Dagny stood staring at the room as if one sense could replace another, as if sight could wipe out sound. She moved her head in a slow circle, trying to find an anchor somewhere. She saw Francisco leaning against a column, his arms crossed. He was looking straight at her. He was laughing. Don't shake like this, she thought. Get out of here. This was the approach of an anger she could not control. She thought, say nothing, walk steadily, get out. She had started walking cautiously, very slowly. She heard Lillian's words and stopped. Lillian had said it many times this evening in answer to the same question, but it was the first time that Dagny heard it. This? Lillian was saying, extending her arm with a metal bracelet for the inspection of two smartly groomed women. Why, no, it's not from a hardware store. It's a very special gift from my husband.
Oh, yes, of course, it's hideous, but don't you see? It's supposed to be priceless. Of course, I'd exchange it for a common diamond bracelet any time, but somehow nobody will offer me one for it, even though it is so very, very valuable.
Why?
My dear, it's the first thing ever made of Reardon metal.
Dagny did not see the room. She did not hear the music. She felt the pressure of dead stillness against her eardrums. She did not know the moment that preceded or the moments that were to follow. She did not know those involved, neither herself, nor Lillian, nor Reardon, nor the meaning of her own action. It was a single instant, blasted out of context. She had heard. She was looking at the bracelet of green-blue metal. She felt the movement of something being torn off her wrist, and she heard her own voice, saying in the great stillness, very calmly, a voice cold as a skeleton, naked of emotion, "If you are not the coward that I think you are, you will exchange it." On the palm of her hand, she was extending her diamond bracelet to Lillian.
"You're not serious, Miss Taggart," said a woman's voice.
It was not Lillian's voice. Lillian's eyes were looking straight at her. She saw them. Lillian knew that she was serious. "Give me that bracelet," said Dagny, lifting her palm higher, the diamond band glittering across it.
"This is horrible," cried some woman.
It was strange that the cry stood out so sharply. Then Dagny realized that there were people standing around them, and that they all stood in silence. She was hearing sounds now, even the music. It was Halley's mangled concerto somewhere far away. She saw Reardon's face. It looked as if something within him were mangled like the music. She did not know by what. He was watching them. Lillian's mouth moved into an upturned crescent. It resembled a smile. She snapped the metal bracelet open, dropped it on Dagny's palm, and took the diamond band.
"Thank you, Miss Taggart," she said.
Dagny's fingers closed about the metal. She felt that. She felt nothing else. Lillian turned because Reardon had approached her. He took the diamond bracelet from her hand. He clasped it on her wrist, raised her hand to his lips, and kissed it. He did not look at Dagny. Lillian laughed gaily, easily, attractively, bringing the room back to its normal mood.
"You may have it back, Miss Taggart, when you change your mind," she said.
Dagny had turned away. She felt calm and free. The pressure was gone. The need to get out had vanished. She clasped the metal bracelet on her wrist. She liked the feel of the weight against her skin. Inexplicably, she felt a touch of feminine vanity, the kind she had never experienced before, the desire to be seen wearing this particular ornament. From a distance, she heard snatches of indignant voices. "The most offensive gesture I've ever seen.
It was vicious. I'm glad Lillian took her up on it.
Serves her right if she feels like throwing a few $1,000 away." For the rest of the evening, Reardon remained by the side of his wife. He shared her conversations. He laughed with her friends. He was suddenly the devoted, attentive, admiring husband. He was crossing the room carrying a tray of drinks requested by someone in Lillian's group, an unbecoming act of informality which nobody had ever seen him perform, when Dagny approached him. She stopped and looked up at him, as if they were alone in his office. She stood like an executive, her head lifted. He looked down at her. In the line of his glance, from the fingertips of her one hand to her face, her body was naked but for his metal bracelet. "I'm sorry, Hank," she said, "but I had to do it." His eyes remained expressionless, yet she was suddenly certain that she knew what he felt. He wanted to slap her face. "It was not necessary," he answered coldly, and walked on. It was very late when Reardon entered his wife's bedroom. She was still awake. A lamp burned on her bedside table. She lay in bed propped up on pillows of pale green linen. Her bed jacket was pale green satin, worn with the untouched perfection of a window model. Its lustrous folds looked as if the crinkle of tissue paper still lingered among them. The light, shaded to a tone of apple blossoms, fell on a table that held a book, a glass of fruit juice, and toilet accessories of silver, glittering like instruments in a surgeon's case. Her arms had a tinge of porcelain. There was a touch of pale pink lipstick on her mouth. She showed no sign of exhaustion after the party, no sign of life to be exhausted. The place was a decorator's display of a lady groomed for sleep, not to be disturbed. He still wore his dress clothes. His tie was loose, and a strand of hair hung over his face. She glanced at him without astonishment, as if she knew what the last hour in his room had done to him. He looked at her silently. He had not entered her room for a long time. He stood, wishing he had not entered it now. "Isn't it customary to talk, Henry?"
"If you wish."
"I wish you'd send one of your brilliant experts from the mills to take a look at our furnace. Do you know that it went out during the party, and Simon's had a terrible time getting it started again? Mrs. Weston says that our best achievement is our cook. She loved the hors d'oeuvres. Balfe Eubank said a very funny thing about you. He said you're a crusader with a factory's chimney smoke for a plume. I'm glad you don't like Francisco D'Anconia. I can't stand him."
He did not care to explain his presence, or to disguise defeat, or to admit it by leaving. Suddenly it did not matter to him what she guessed or felt. He walked to the window and stood looking out. Why had she married him, he thought? It was a question he had not asked himself on their wedding day 8 years ago. Since then, in tortured loneliness, he had asked it many times. He had found no answer. It was not for position, he thought, or for money. She came from an old family that had both. Her family's name was not among the most distinguished, and their fortune was modest. But both were sufficient to let her be included in the top circles of New York society where he had met her. 9 years ago he had appeared in New York like an explosion, in the glare of the success of Reardon Steele, a success that had been thought impossible by the city's experts. It was his indifference that had made him spectacular. He did not know that he was expected to attempt to buy his way into society, and that they anticipated the pleasure of rejecting him. He had no time to notice their disappointment. He attended reluctantly a few social occasions to which he was invited by men who sought his favor. He did not know, but they knew, that his courteous politeness was condescension toward the people who had expected to snub him, the people who had said that the age of achievement was past. It was Lillian's austerity that attracted him, the conflict between her austerity and her behavior. He had never liked anyone, or expected to be liked. He found himself held by the spectacle of a woman who was obviously pursuing him, but with obvious reluctance, as if against her own will, as if fighting a desire she resented. It was she who planned that they should meet, then faced him coldly, as if not caring that he knew it. She spoke little. She had an air of mystery that seemed to tell him he would never break through her proud detachment, and an air of amusement, mocking her own desire and his. He had not known many women. He had moved toward his goal, sweeping aside everything that did not pertain to it in the world and in himself. His dedication to his work was like one of the fires he dealt with, a fire that burned every lesser element, every impurity, out of the white stream of a single metal. He was incapable of halfway concerns. But there were times when he felt a sudden access of desire, so violent that it could not be given to a casual encounter. He had surrendered to it on a few rare occasions through the years with women he had thought he liked. He had been left feeling an angry emptiness because he had sought an act of triumph, though he had not known of what nature. But the response he received was only a woman's acceptance of a casual pleasure, and he knew too clearly that what he had won had no meaning. He was left not with a sense of attainment, but with a sense of his own degradation. He grew to hate his desire. He fought it. He came to believe the doctrine that this desire was wholly physical, a desire not of consciousness but of matter, and he rebelled against the thought that his flesh could be free to choose, and that its choice was impervious to the will of his mind. He had spent his life in mines and mills, shaping matter to his wishes by the power of his brain, and he found it intolerable that he should be unable to control the matter of his own body. he fought it. He had won his every battle against inanimate nature, but this was a battle he lost. It was the difficulty of the conquest that made him want Lillian. She seemed to be a woman who expected and deserved a pedestal. This made him want to drag her down to his bed. To drag her down, were the words in his mind. They gave him a dark pleasure, the sense of a victory worth winning. He could not understand why. He thought it was an obscene conflict, the sign of some secret depravity within him. Why he felt at the same time a profound pride at the thought of granting to a woman the title of his wife. The feeling was solemn and shining. It was almost as if he felt that he wished to honor a woman by the act of possessing her. Lillian seemed to fit the image he had not known he held, had not known he wished to find. He saw the grace, the pride, the purity. The rest was in himself. He did not know that he was looking at a reflection. He remembered the day when Lillian came from New York to his office, of her own sudden choice, and asked him to take her through his mills. He heard a soft, low, breathless tone, the tone of admiration growing in her voice, as she questioned him about his work and looked at the place around her. He looked at her graceful figure moving against the bursts of furnace flame, and at the light, swift steps of her high heels, stumbling through drifts of slag as she walked resolutely by his side. The look in her eyes, when she watched a heat of steel being poured, was like his own feeling for it, made visible to him. When her eyes moved up to his face, he saw the same look, but intensified to a degree that seemed to make her helpless and silent. It was at dinner that evening that he asked her to marry him. It took him some time after his marriage before he admitted to himself that this was torture. He still remembered the night when he admitted it, when he told himself, the veins of his wrists pulled tight as he stood by the bed looking down at Lillian, that he deserved the torture, and that he would endure it. Lillian was not looking at him. She was adjusting her hair. "May I go to sleep now?" she asked. She had never objected. She had never refused him anything. She submitted whenever he wished. She submitted in the manner of complying with the rule that it was at times her duty to become an inanimate object turned over to her husband's use. She did not censure him. She made it clear that she took it for granted that men had degrading instincts, which constituted the secret, ugly part of marriage. She was condescendingly tolerant. She smiled in amused distaste at the intensity of what he experienced. "It's the most undignified pastime I know of," she said to him once. "But I have never entertained the illusion that men are superior to animals." His desire for her had died in the first week of their marriage. What remained was only a need which he was unable to destroy. He had never entered a whorehouse. He thought at times that the self-loathing he would experience there could be no worse than what he felt when he was driven to enter his wife's bedroom. He would often find her reading a book. She would put it aside with a white ribbon to mark the pages. When he lay exhausted, his eyes closed, still breathing in gasps, she would turn on the light, pick up the book, and continue her reading. He told himself that he deserved the torture, because he had wished never to touch her again, and was unable to maintain his decision. He despised himself for that. He despised a need which now held no shred of joy or meaning, which had become the mere need of a woman's body. An anonymous body that belonged to a woman whom he had to forget while he held it. He became convinced that the need was depravity. He did not condemn Lillian. He felt a dreary, indifferent respect for her. His hatred of his own desire had made him accept the doctrine that women were pure, and that a pure woman was one incapable of physical pleasure. Through the quiet agony of the years of his marriage, there had been one thought which he would not permit himself to consider, the thought of infidelity. He had given his word. He intended to keep it. It was not loyalty to Lillian. It was not the person of Lillian that he wished to protect from dishonor, but the person of his wife. He thought of that now standing at the window. He had not wanted to enter her room. He had fought against it. He had fought more fiercely against knowing the particular reason why he would not be able to withstand it tonight. Then, seeing her, He had known suddenly that he would not touch her. The reason which had driven him here tonight was the reason which made it impossible for him. He stood still, feeling free of desire, feeling the bleak relief of indifference to his body, to this room, even to his presence here. He had turned away from her not to see her lacquered chastity. What he thought he should feel was respect. What he felt was revulsion.